welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about very important developments in the Congo. Could be very relevant to a lot of our electronics, depending on how this plays out. We're also going to talk about the issue of violence in Baltimore, as well as some upcoming House races of note. But before we can move on, well, looks like they couldn't get it done. Senate Republicans appear to not have the votes to either repeal or replace the Affordable Care Act, much less to do both. While there are some pro forma moves to make it look like they are still trying, it seems Republicans are more or less giving up on this effort to end the ACA. President Trump seems to be defaulting to his stated fallback position as well, stating that he thinks they should just, quote, let Obamacare fail. This is a stunning political defeat for Republicans, who more or less defeated themselves. They hold all the necessary levers of power and only had to come to consensus amongst their own caucus, and they couldn't do it. This despite 7 straight years of constantly repeating that they would repeal and replace so-called Obamacare, and after a presidential primary where just about every GOP candidate said this would be their number one priority to roll back this ACA law. And somehow, in all that time, with all that talking, no one seemed to ever sit down and actually try to figure out what they would do. So when the time came, it was not possible to build any real consensus, which in and of itself reveals one of the biggest issues with the whole thing. The Affordable Care Act was a Republican plan. It was the Mitt Romney-designed health care plan he implemented in Massachusetts while he was governor of the state. And at the root of this whole controversy is revealed what obviously Romney must have known then, that having tens of millions of people without health care is morally unacceptable and actually more costly to society than if the government plays some role. This is something that is widely understood, whatever other disagreements there may be. Hence why we would see the Republican bill immediately tank once it became clear that it would drastically increase the numbers of the uninsured by tens of millions of people, and that it could actually cause significant numbers of deaths due to people's health care being wrenched away. The widespread opposition was felt throughout the whole process of tens of thousands of people packed into town halls and protested more or less incessantly at local offices and also in the Capitol building in D.C. It got so intense that large numbers of Republicans just started canceling town halls and meetings in their districts because they just didn't want to hear it. I think it became totally clear to many Republican senators that they would be in serious risk of losing their seats if they went forward with this proposed health care plan. In the House, the situation is a little different because so many members are in gerrymandered districts where it's easier for them to vote to do what they said because they face less risk, more risk perhaps, for not doing what they said. In statewide races, however, it's highly different. And Republican governors in states that expanded Medicaid more or less revolted on the Republican Congress, recognizing also that they could not just take away Medicaid from millions and not face serious problems. Bottom line, people more or less do not think there should be tens of millions of people without health care, that most people should have access to quality health care, and that the government can play some role. So the reverse of all that just was never going to work. What happens now? Who knows? There's a bipartisan group of 11 governors trying to get Congress to jumpstart some sort of new process with Republicans and Democrats working together, something that Joe Manchin, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, is also trying to work on. But it seems like most of those efforts are not going to go terribly far. Democrats and Republicans seem about as far apart right now as Republicans are among themselves. Donald Trump claims he's just going to, quote unquote, let it fail. The question is, will he have Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price try to make it fail? For instance, they cannot enforce the individual mandate. They can fail to reimburse insurance companies as well for out-of-pocket costs for low-income customers. Now, insurance companies and Republican governors, though, will be outraged by this, as would many voters as the healthcare system starts to unravel. So that seems also relatively unlikely to happen. So most likely the Republicans will just try to move on to tax reform, something many people had expected would happen if McConnell couldn't get the Senate in line. Stunning, really, to see this happen, but it really outlines the key irony about Republicans. They control Congress and the White House, but most of the policies they actually want to implement are extremely unpopular. When it comes to foreign influence in various countries, apparently all the U.S. media can talk about is Russia. Apparently, no one ever tries to do anything outside of Russia to try to influence anyone. Well, you may be interested to know then that there's currently a minor scandal brewing over in the UK over Japanese influence peddling. The Henry Jackson Society, interestingly enough, named for the U.S. Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, is a well-known neoconservative think tank across the pond. Recently, they have been putting on a number of reports critiquing China and also calling for the government over there to prevent a Chinese company from having deeper investments in a British nuclear reactor, power plant, I should say, for quote-unquote security reasons. However, a Times of London investigation has called into question whether or not these reports are really above board and are now claiming the Japanese government is paying $10,000 per month to HJS to produce anti-China pieces and then get high-level MPs and political figures to sign on and promote these reports to help them get into the media. This, of course, should not be terribly surprising. In fact, as it concerns think tanks, it's par for the course. Foreign governments routinely fund think tanks in the U.S. and Europe around either certain issues or overall funding to try to influence the advice they give to lawmakers in their respective countries. Norway, for instance, evil Norway, has paid the Brookings Institution $5 million to push the U.S. government on a very particular aid program. Qatar, also in the news a lot these days, gives Brookings tens of millions of dollars and helped them build a gleaming new campus in Doha to expand their global reach. Sometimes there's an exact quid pro quo. Sometimes it's just generally staying on side, as it were, but lots of influence. So the general point is, yet again, here we have key evidence that foreign influence peddling in major Western capitals is a huge thing. It deeply implicates all the major parties and institutions, and it would behoove people who claim to be concerned about this sort of thing to pay attention to the obvious corruption right in front of your eyes, as opposed to the shadow game being played out via anonymous sources in the media. Well, one thing the Trump era has done is create a range of studies into issues of hate crimes in the U.S. The Council for American Islamic Relations has just released a report on anti-Muslim hate incidents in the first 6 months of 2017. They detail a 91% increase from the same time period last year. And 2016 was the worst year for anti-Muslim hate crimes since the group started monitoring them in 2013. 2017 appears to be on course to be the worst yet then. According to the Mike.com review of the report, quote, harassment accounts for 16% of the total 451 reported bias incidents, hate crimes followed with 15%, then incidents where the FBI inappropriately targeted complainants of incidents weighing in at 12%, and the last two common types of abuse and incidents were acts of intimidation in cases involving the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which accounted for 12% and 8%, respectively, of cases reported in the second quarter of 2017. It's worth noting here the prevalence of state actors and anti-Muslim bias in this country. It's also a good note for people who say speech doesn't promote action. Clearly, the rising tide of Islamophobia stoked by the president and his allies is emboldening racist and anti-Muslim bigots to unleash their hate. Marin and San Mateo counties, coastal counties just outside of San Francisco in the U.S. state of California, are suing 37 fossil fuel companies, accusing them of knowing their products were harmful but not telling people. This case is bound to be tough to prove, but it's reminiscent of the lawsuits that ultimately brought Big Tobacco down. Once it became clear to the public that Big Tobacco not only knew how dangerous cigarettes were, but actively tried to make them more addictive and more attractive to younger and younger audiences despite what they knew— Well, once that happened, all the PR in the world couldn't save them, put a huge target on their back, and drastically reduced the scope of smoking in this country. Now, these two California counties are accusing Big Oil of that exact same thing. We'll have to see how it plays out in terms of whether it'll work or not, but I have to say, this novel approach has at the very least opened a new front in the battle around climate change. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we slightly switch gears by Maurice Carney, who is the co-founder and executive director of the Friends of the Congo. Maurice, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Eugene.
Oh, of course. And so the sort of big news that is in the air here is the continued repression of popular forces by the Kabila government. But I wanted to start on a slightly more framing note. I think a lot of our listeners may know a little bit about Congo, but not a lot. And I wanted to just start with this issue of how strategically important the Congo really is. I mean, sort of the battle over, you know, who is really going to rule there has huge implications, you know, in terms of the economics of the world, the politics of the African continent. I was hoping you could just say a little bit about that, sort of the importance and critical pivot that the Congo really is.
Sure. Congo is central to the future of the African continent. In fact, when the African continent was carved up at the Berlin Conference, 1884-1885, Congo was key to that carving up. It was, the conference was also called the Congo Conference. And Congo was so important that no European nation would colonize it at the time. It was given to King Leopold II as his own personal property, provided that all the other European states had free trade and free commerce in the country. So, and it has remained that way right to this day. One thing that revolutionaries and reactionaries and conservative forces, imperialists, anti-imperialists, are in agreement with is the centrality of the Congo to the future of the African continent. When the United States, under the CIA, overthrew Patrice Lumumba in 1960, the chief of station of the CIA in the Congo, Larry Devlin, stated in his book, Chief of Station Congo, that we had to overthrow Lumumba. Because if we didn't overthrow Lumumba, not only would we have lost the Congo, but we'd have lost all of Africa. So the Congo was the first post-independence country that the United States intervened in to overthrow a democratically elected leader, which the listening audience should take note of with all the talk about Russian interference in U.S. elections. We see that the Congo, the U.S., probably, one can argue, the greatest destructive force on the African continent or in countries that the United States have invaded has occurred, or intervened in rather, has occurred in the Congo. If we look, we see the U.S. intervene in Iran, Guatemala, Chile. They're all known to your listening audience, but the Congo has been, in our estimation, the most destructive of interventions that we've seen. So Congo is central to the future of the African continent. Kwame Nkrumah, the great Pan-African leader of Ghana, he wrote a book entitled The Challenge of the Congo, where he saw Congo serving as the economic engine for the development of the United States of Africa, the Pan-African project that Nkrumah had laid out.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great overview. I said to this morning, someone this morning, I said, if you need a one sentence explanation, just think of it like this. Without Congo, there are no cell phones, given the importance of coltan. So it gives you a sense of why this is such a strategic battle that everyone around the world in the terms of countries and imperialist companies care about, even if the media doesn't. So, I want to also then go to the next framing. We had two young activists who were arrested here. I mean, it seemed to have some shades to me of the disappearances in some ways that took place in Chile. And this is part of ongoing, if I'm correct here, and then correct me if I'm wrong, sort of ongoing repression of these popular movements that have been happening in the Congo, led by young people that have really challenged the government there and started to push a really sort of, it seems to me, very powerful movement to renew the politics there.
Over the past 16 years, the current leader of the Congo, his name is Joseph Kabila, has been fully backed by the United States and Western powers. And really since his entree into the leadership of the country, he has undertaken repressive practices, disappearing people, jailing people, killing, stealing elections. And all of this have been endorsed by the U.S. government from 2001, really up until recently. So, according to Congo's constitution, Kabila had to leave office on December 19th, and he's refused to do so. And in the face of his attempt to remain in power, the youth have risen up to challenge him. Most notably, in January of 2015, the Telema movement stood up to challenge a law that the Kabila government wanted to pass and enact, in order to enshrine his stay in power. Due to the resistance of the youth at a very dear price, some four dozen lives had been taken, hundreds had been injured and arrested. They were able to resist the imposition of that law by Kabila. So what Kabila has done is to unfurl a two-pronged approach. One is to seek to repress people at home, and two is to go on a diplomatic offensive abroad among African leaders. He's hired at least two lobby firms here in Washington. He's invested $5.6 million in lobbying Washington to continue to support his repressive practices at home. Most notably is Bob Dole's lobbying firm. He's hired them. Bob Livingston, the former senator of Louisiana, has been engaged as well, and some of individuals who participated in the Trump campaign. So he's unleashed an offensive, a diplomatic offensive, while repressing the youth at home. And two young people who have been at the forefront of resisting Kabila, Jean-Marie Kalonji and Silva Mbakayi, they have a group called the Fourth Way. They were put into a military detention camp because of their activities in organizing people on the ground.
Mm. And say a little bit more, too, about where they've been taken and what that is, because I think this is a very crucial situation. I mean, they haven't just been arrested, but really could seriously be in danger here.
Yeah, no, their lives are in danger. their lives are in danger. And they were captured not by the police, but by the military. And they were put into a place called Demiap. It's a military detention camp in Kinshasa. And efforts have been made on the inside to get them out. We've actually gotten some good news that they may have been released. Efforts were made on the outside by Amnesty International. They issued an urgent call for the release of Jean-Marie and Silva. And it's important for people to understand on this side of the Atlantic, Eugene, these young people are similar to the youths that you see in the Black Lives Matter movement. They're undertaking a social justice pursuit to transform their society, to establish a self-sufficient country that is independent, unified with the rest of Africa, and is anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist. So the Kabila regime do not take kindly to young people who are standing up in this way, and they've militarized Congolese society. It's nearly impossible to organize in university campuses. They have intelligence agencies throughout. There are checkpoints set up throughout the city. Youth are not able to gather in more than 10 at a time. That kind of reminds you of the vagrancy laws that were instituted here in the U.S. Mm. So they're experiencing a police state. And this police state has been supported by the United States, the military equipment. I don't know if you recall, one of the main complaints around Ferguson was the excess military equipment that was sent there and being used against youth there. Well, the United States also sent excess military equipment to the Congolese government, which are used against the Congolese youth to repress them.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining the show and giving us this brief update. I really hope people check out Friends of the Congo, continue to follow this story. That was Maurice Carney, who's the executive director of Friends of the Congo. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, we are very happy to be continuing our conversation talking a little bit about the city of Baltimore and some issues coming out of there around criminal justice issues, I guess would be a great way to describe it. And we are very happy to be joined by Christopher Burnett, a Baltimore City Council member. Christopher, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is all ours. A lot going on there. I wanted to just start with this sort of newish news. And so still a lot of things coming out, but just a lot to this. The body camera footage that has come out from the public defenders that has now caused an investigation looks like two police officers planting evidence, drug evidence. The guy who was ultimately arrested in jail, $50,000 bond. Now it looks like it's going to be a much bigger deal. As a Baltimore City Council member, I mean, what are your first thoughts on seeing this story?
It was shocking, especially in the wake of us, you know, trying to implement a consent decree for many of the same issues with the Department of Justice and still trying to rebuild trust within the community between the police department and the citizens of Baltimore. So it was very shocking, very disappointing. And, you know, and that's also, you know, coming on the heels of the arrest of seven officers who were a part of a gun trace task force who were also are being accused of similar tactics. And so, you know, it's disappointing that there still seems to be a culture of, you know, of corruption in the Baltimore Police Department that, you know, I know the commissioner is working on to try and get rid of those bad officers. And you know, it's a tough one, right? Because I know officers personally in the Baltimore Police Department that do work incredibly hard, and it does not do well for their reputation to have officers doing this sort of tactics to try and close a case. And so I actually heard about it this morning. I'll serve on the City Council's Public Safety Committee, so I'm certain we will be discussing this in the coming weeks and bringing in the commissioner and the leadership of Baltimore Police to explain what's going on and to hold them accountable.
Well, and I think the last point you said there is very key. I mean, certainly during the Baltimore uprising and after, I think that was a lot of the questions that people had. I know you came to the council in the wake of a lot of that, the national scrutiny on the city of Baltimore showing a lot of these things. And I think that's what people felt. So, I mean, in some ways, does this feel to you like the type of situation that you ran for to be in a position to have a voice and to be able to say, okay, there's people in here now who aren't just going to sweep this stuff under the rug?
Yeah, and I think that's been – so we've had a huge election in April 2016 and in November 2016 for the general, which brought in eight new council members, the youngest council in the history of Baltimore, and it's the biggest turnover that the city's ever had. And I think part of that was a mandate on behalf of the citizens of Baltimore to see a different sort of council and government that does hold agencies accountable and does ask those tough questions and does push for reform. And I think we have that on this council for the most part. You know, there's always going to be differences in agreeing on what to do and how to move forward. But regardless of the political alignment of each individual member, I think we have seen a council that is willing to push hard and fast and swiftly to get justice for the citizens of Baltimore and to shed light and not afraid to talk about these sort of issues.
And, you know, I'm curious here, and then just to sort of switch gears, other big sort of criminal justice issue that has come up in Baltimore and really kind of rocketed around the country. I think a lot of cities certainly are looking at Baltimore to see how folks are dealing with community violence there. Unfortunately, I think has come a little bit of a meme in the national media. But nevertheless, the mayor, Catherine Pugh, she has this new proposal, which is a mandatory 1-year minimum for anyone, correct me if I'm wrong here, for anyone who is arrested with a gun, I believe. And that surprised a lot of people, given that mandatory minimums haven't really proven to be terribly effective. But obviously, the issues of community violence in Baltimore have been significant. Where are you falling on this issue of the 1-year mandatory minimum?
I've been vocally opposed. I think you articulated my perspective and my concern in that many cities across the country, and from the research that we've been pulled together, my office has been able to pull together, 25 cities have either gotten rid of mandatory minimums altogether or taking steps to roll them back piece by piece, or have legislated safety valves to, you know, make them a little bit more reasonable. You know, there's been a rolling back, and that's because in no jurisdiction has it proven to actually reduce violence in any city. And we can look to other cities of similar size or states of similar size. Virginia's had them, Maine, Boston, Chicago, Florida, to name a few. But all across the country, we've seen these peel back. And we have 30 years of information that shows us that they don't work. And so I've been highly vocal in opposition to this bill, and will continue to do so because I don't think it's the answer. We are under a tremendous amount of pressure to do something, but I'd rather do something that we know will work and not perpetuate the problem that we have, which is, you know, on several other previous administrations, you know, there was zero tolerance policing, and we arrested over 100,000 residents of Baltimore. And in many of those same neighborhoods, we have the highest levels of returning citizens coming back home, and many of which have a difficult time finding work and return to the lifestyle that got them incarcerated in the first place. And I don't think rolling back the clock on policy that we know is ineffective, and both what we've seen in locally in Baltimore City, but we have a national landscape that is moving away from that and is looking towards other ways to address the systemic causes of violence, which we know are rooted in public health. And I've called on my colleagues to think of it in that perspective. And I think it's criminal for us to not legislate from a public health lens and try and get to the root causes of violence. And we know that sentencing is not a deterrent for violence. There's three reasons that, for the most part, people carry an illegal weapon, which is what this bill is targeting. And, you know, you're either using it in an act of murder, robbery, or you're protecting yourself from the other two. Mm-hmm. And in none of those instances is the prospect of a one-year sentence going to deter that behavior, because we have neighborhoods in Baltimore that the life expectancy is similar to what you'd see in Syria, mm-hmm. in some instances, in other countries that are war-torn. And so I've talked to some folks, and some of those areas are in the district that I represent. And talking to some guys, I mean, they're not going to not carry a weapon because, you know, using their words, they'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Mm. And so they are going to still carry a weapon and deal with the consequences. And so my concern with that is it doesn't really get at the root issue of violence. It doesn't target the few individuals we know are causing most of the violence, the violent repeat offenders. It's a small number of individuals that are doing this, and a lot of folks carry weapons to protect themselves from those very people. And I'm all for getting, you know, those people off the streets, but that's not what this law does. That's not what mandatory minimums do, and it doesn't make our community safer. I would argue that it's a temporary fix that we pay for later.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that there's a lot of evidence certainly to recommend what you're saying being 100% true. And I think that one of the things I always sort of am curious about too here is from a legislator's perspective. I mean, it seems that what the mayor is doing, although I guess she's not a legislator, she's an administrator, but nevertheless, it just seems like this is exactly what got us in the problem the first time with mass incarceration, is you had so many people who see something bad happen and the response becomes, well, let's just do something, as opposed to actually taking a deeper look at it. And I'm curious, I mean, is that something that you think people are really hungry for now, which is not sort of the quick fix, but the like, okay, how can we do something that 20 years from now isn't going to be a difference? I mean, is that maybe sort of a difference in the legislative environment between, say, now and 1994?
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, look, like I said, we are under pressure to do something now. I've received some angry calls and emails from many of my constituents who are not happy that I don't intend to support this legislation. And in a few instances, I've been able to change their minds as to once I present the research and the data and show them that we have over 20 years of information to go on. And it would be malpractice for us to implement legislation that we know does not work. And having that, you know, this is not innovative. It's not new. And it's been tried. And, you know, and I understand, you know, where my colleagues are coming from and that, like, you know, like I said, we are getting calls and we're meeting with families who've lost their sons and daughters to violence, and they want something done. They want it now. I mean, we're approaching 200 murders very quickly and are likely to hit 300 by the end of the year at this pace. And so there's a lot of pressure to do something. And it sounds good. It sounds like good policy on the surface. But once you dig beneath the surface, it's not what it seems to be. And I've tried to express that as the best I can to all of my constituents and to my colleagues and lobbying them to vote this down.
Mm. And I'm curious what the because I can imagine that you guys are under a lot of pressure, and I'm curious to some degree how you feel about how the sort of the non-Baltimore media coverage of what's been going on there has been affecting it, because I always kind of feel one of two ways. I mean, on the one hand, okay, sure, it's a story. I can get why, say, the New York Times would want to report on the quote-unquote murder rate in Baltimore given the history of the past few years. But that being said, I always feel like the picture it paints is never quite right. I mean, I've had the privilege and pleasure of being all over the city of Baltimore. And even in, like, the quote-unquote worst neighborhoods, I meet great people. There's community. There's so much. And I think sometimes, like, that's something that seems to get lost when we're talking about how do we solve these problems. Like, no one is saying, like, hey, this is a community. Let's go in here. Let's heal communities. It's just like, oh, it's just a bunch of – like, it's a bombed-out moonscape with a bunch of crazy people running around shooting people, which is just not – actually what's taking place. And I wonder how you feel about that kind of image that – I don't know. Maybe you feel that that's not what people are doing. But it seems to me a lot of the stuff I see nationally about Baltimore is really kind of hewing on this line.
I would agree. I don't have cable, so I don't get a lot of the national news, unfortunately. So I'm not the best person to ask about that. But I do remember – I mean, I was out in the uprising with trying to calm things down with an organization called 300 Men March. And did get calls from all over the country from people both concerned. But then I did at that point try my best to tune into some of the national media to see how they were depicting the city. And it was interesting because, one, you'd see blocks that folks were being, that was being depicted as being a result of the uprising. And I was looking like, oh, that block kind of looked like that for a while.
Mm.
But also, you'd see these depictions that the whole city was somehow on fire, and it really was a very small area in Baltimore City that was experiencing the uprising. But I'd say that's also, you know, so I would agree with you that especially in 2015, that was the case. I would imagine it probably still is. And I would 1,000% agree that it does not tell the whole story. You know, we have several neighborhoods that are definitely gripping with violence and vacancy and blight. But we also have neighborhoods that are beautiful. And in any of these neighborhoods, you're correct that there are people who care about their community that still sweep from their front steps, are still working with young people and active in schools and are active in their community groups and trying to turn things around as best they can. And that story isn't getting told. But you know, for me, it's also about trying to control the narrative myself and what I promote and what I try to tell my constituents to hold strong and highlighting the things that they're doing. I mean, there's great things that are happening, and I can't control what the national media is doing, but we can try to make life better for the people who actually live here, and they see it day to day, right? So mm-hmm. as long as they see progress, as long as they see things happening in their community that are positive, you know, I do sleep well at night and don't really lose too much over what the New York Times has to say or CNN or Fox has to say about our city.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad you brought up 300 Men March as well, because one of the things that I have always liked about Baltimore, and I think is interesting of major cities, certainly with large black populations, is there is a lot of grassroots anti-violence work that goes on coming out of communities. Maybe doesn't get as much news, but I do know that one thing that did get the news was the Weekend Without Killings. I mean, there's a lot of people who are out
ceasefire, yeah.
Exactly, trying to be engaged. So talk about that a little bit for us, if you could, sort of the grassroots peace movement in the city, because I really think that's both unique and a great thing for folks and other cities have similar issues to know about.
Sure. So I'm also very much supportive of Baltimore Ceasefire, which is a part of the Baltimore Peace Challenge, where they're pushing for a weekend without violence from August 4th and August 16th or August 6th, which is interesting because you mentioned the national media. It was actually this morning. I do read Reddit, and it was the number one post on Reddit. And, you know, unfortunately, I'd say, because that's not what you want to see is the top post on Reddit is more about violence in Baltimore. But I'll say this, I know the organizers of that. One of their key organizers actually is a constituent of mine. And they are, you know, it's kind of gotten an unfair spin in that, like, you know, why are we asking for just a single weekend and not an end to violence altogether? But what folks haven't really seen and the story hasn't been told is how much direct outreach has been done about that. And it's really, yeah, it's pushing for a weekend, but the success of that movement isn't whether, and we hope that we are successful in ending violence for that time period. But really the motive behind it is to try and change the culture of violence, which is pervasive in many parts of our city, and doing direct outreach in over that weekend. And so it's not just an ask to not to kill anyone, but it's also an ask for communities to have cookouts and sleepouts on blocks and movie nights and anything that builds community, build relationships, and really trying to restore a sense of pride in community and city in our city. But also get folks talking to each other about violence and about connecting our young people to the resources that they need. And that hasn't been the narrative around that movement. But like I said, it's an effort to really, really push to change the conversation among the people who live here every single day. And also building bridges with the young men and women that are you know, engaging in that lifestyle and are carrying weapons and using them to end lives and to really try and restore that pride and give them something to live for and respecting humanity. And which is why I've been very supportive of that and movement. And there will be actually in the Irvington community, which is in my district, there will be every single day around the clock, there'll be activities going on in that stretch, which happens to be the most violent part of my district. But it's being led by, you know, the community and the faith groups and business leaders all rallying around to try and, you know, be a part of that. But also it's not going to end that weekend. And I think there'll be more to come. So just stay tuned on that. But, you know, it's not just the weekend. We're not going to just pack up and say, all right, get back at it. But to really continue to chip away at changing that culture that has engripped our city.
Mm-hmm. Well, great work there for sure, and all around. I really appreciate you being willing to join the show here, Christopher. That was Christopher Burnett. He is a Baltimore City Council member, so definitely get your Google alerts going there, because I'm sure they'll have a lot of interesting things happening there from this new, very young council in Baltimore moving forward. We're going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the first congressional district in Wisconsin. And yes, you are not mistaken. That is the district in which Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is from. He will be up for election next year. So to discuss all of the things swirling around this, we are very happy to be joined by Ed Sadlowski, who is a Ask Me Council 31 representative. Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Eugene, thanks for having me on. Much appreciated.
No, of course, of course. And so Mr. Ryan is getting ready to run for re-election. He's drawing some challengers. But, you know, the first question I really want to ask here is, you know, what is your has what's happened over health care and Trump and so on and so forth changed the calculus in that district? I know that Paul Ryan usually wins with 60-some% of the vote. I mean, is there anything that you think has changed sort of in the big picture that's making him more vulnerable?
Well, yeah, I personally do. Again, when you look at the first congressional district, it's a wide band of southeast Wisconsin. Bookend by two really old Rust Belt towns, Janesville on the west end, and Kenosha County on the east end, and so a lot of working class people that have been through hard times over the last couple of decades, for sure. Closing at a GM plant in Janesville, you know, large. I think that's the largest capital stock in GM's portfolio, just by way of the size of the facility, right in Paul Ryan's backyard, literally, a stone's throw from his house. And then on the east end, Kenosha, again, formerly very much industrial manufacturing, Alice Chalmers, Kenosha auto workers, but again, confronted with hard knocks over the last couple of decades, like many, many towns, you know, similarly situated. And Trump exploited the hell out of that, as you know, with a progressive message. He's going to even bring back steel mills, apparently. But even anyway, but not understanding the nuances of those industries, the technology and the challenges, et cetera, you know, what's displaced so many workers in this country. Anyhow, so it's an interesting situation. And a lot of people did gravitate towards Trump. Working families during the election looked desperate for change, you know, and clinging to that pot, including union households, unfortunately, much like they did with Scott Walker again and again, you know, even though stripping workers of rights. Working families are either wedded to that party system still or just desperate for change at any cost. But this time is a little different in the sense of we got two very viable Democratic challengers that have stepped up all of a sudden in the first congressional district. One is an iron worker, Randy Bryce, who lives in the Kenosha area, and the other, a former 23-year school teacher, Kathy Myers. A good, strong union woman and a good, strong union man, trade unionists, activists, community leaders. Now, this is different than what's happened in Paul's career. He's actually going to face a viable challenger this time, maybe for the first time in his political career. So it's shaping up to be a real interesting Democratic primary, which there's been some debate about within the progressive movement. You know, like, is that a good thing? I believe it is.
Well, I want to jump in on that because I think that's an important question, because it seems that the controversy, for people who don't know, is some people feel that Randy Bryce, who's a former building trades worker, is, for lack of a better term, sort of soft on climate change issues and so on and so forth. So there's some back and forth around whether or not, you know, he's progressive enough or whatever it may be. And so it's interesting to see, to hear you say that, because it seems like most everyone else I've talked to seems to be taking a side one way or the other.
Yeah, it's been a really healthy debate in the community. Good pals, you know. And again, if you go back just a little bit in Wisconsin, the uprising in 2011, the new discussions, new awareness, new citizen activism. I'm having those same debates as some pals that we all went through that struggle together and learned from it, and we're all better people because of it. You know, who you siding up with? And I'm hearing the same thing, Eugene. People are telling me that Kathy is, you know, her more stronger on the environmental issues, that kind of stuff. And I've known both from afar, just to be honest about it. I live in Janesville, but I'm not in the first congressional district. I live directly across the street from it. I'm lucky to have Representative Mark Pocan as my Congress representative, but he lives up in Madison. So I live like two miles from Paul Ryan, but my congressman lives about 45 miles from me. But anyway, both Kathy serves on the Janesville School Board now as a retired teacher, very much an environmental activist, very much at the forefront of local politics. I've been to her home many times. We've marched to Paul Ryan's house from her house. She lives right up the street from, Paul. And so this is really shaping up to be a really healthy thing for the first congressional district and then the nation as well, because if we can, come out of the primary in the Democratic side with a strong, viable candidate for the first time in Paul Ryan's political career, the whole nation's going to benefit from it. Randy was first out of the gate, you know, with his announcement and a very, I think he came out with a really neat video, you know, that went viral. People are so desperate for change in the sense of progressive change and the harm that Paul Ryan's brought to the nation, not only his district, but his politic and philosophy, that it really caught fire, you know, Randy Bryce's video. So a lot of people reaching out to me about Randy, and he's a good guy. You know, he's run once for the state Senate unsuccessfully, I believe for school board once unsuccessfully, too, in the Kenosha area there. So it's shaping up to be a really exciting time for the residents of the first congressional district, and folks should pay attention to it. And if they can figure out who you feel better about and lend a hand, you know, send in $5, $7, whatever they're asking, and get involved, because this one's going to make a big difference. This one's really going to be, again, the word viable, a viable challenge. where we didn't have that the last couple of cycles.
I think that's a great point. And I mean, I think one thing that, also just sort of struck me about both candidates, which, I mean, I hate to say this seems rare, but it does seem rare to me. I mean, to have two working class union candidates in a Democratic primary, which wouldn't seem like a strange thing. I mean, that seems in and of itself to be kind of an important statement around a lot of these conversations around where do quote-unquote progressive politics need to go? How do you know the start to draw to people who are feeling the economy's not working for them? And it just seems like that fact in and of itself, that you have two people who are unambiguously workers, have been workers, they're not professional politicians, they're not consultants or whatever, it just seems refreshing.
Well, we definitely need more iron workers, more teachers, more school bus drivers, you know, more snowplow drivers in elected office. And that's the exciting thing. More school business maintenance workers. The Janesville School District is unique in that sense. We've got a retired active firefighter union member, a retired school building maintenance worker union, a working county public employee union, and Kathy Myers, retired school teacher, like four of the seven members of the Janesville School Board. Again, local politics being so critical, all very active, solid trade unionists, all serving the community in an elected capacity. Kathy comes out of a group called Emerge, which is focused on recruiting and training women to run for office. And it's a nationwide organization. She's a graduate of that program. It's very exciting stuff. We've got a couple of state representatives in Wisconsin that have been cultivated through that group Emerge. So that's also, and it's all good progressive stuff, good progressive women. You know, it's just good stuff and so sorely needed. And people are really stepping up selflessly, you know, around the notion of a citizen-run democracy. You know, it's not the billionaires writing themselves a $50 million check, saying they're self-funded, you know, that kind of malarkey. We don't need it. And it, like you're saying, Eugene, it's really exciting stuff. I was torn as hell because I had encouraged Randy to run, you know, just saw, watching and listening. Hey, count me in. And then sure enough, Kathy announces and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. But now who shall I support? I don't live in the district, but hell, I'm going to get behind both of them and we'll see how we do.
And, you know, one of the things that I think is very relevant here, and I'm glad you really touched a lot on how local these races really are and how, you know, close people are is, you know, with Eric Cantor, I remember that was a huge issue when he ran against David Broad. I mean, obviously the bigger issue is he was paying very little attention, but people felt like this guy, we know where he lives, we know who he is, but he's never around, he's always on Wall Street. And it just seems like Paul Ryan, especially now that he's House Speaker, you know, could be in a similar situation. I mean, do you think that that could be a vulnerability for him?
Well, it clearly is. He's totally disconnected. I've lived again a couple miles from him. I like to think that I'm involved in the local community. Have seen him on three occasions. I can tell you all three occasions: twice at the grocery store, once in a bicycle shop, and the two times in the grocery store, he's run his cattle in the other direction. Hey, Congressman, you know, and when in the bike shop, he pulled up with three SUVs, all filled with Secret Service, and that's where he's at now. He's recently announced that he's not going to have town hall meetings because of the so-called protests. So he doesn't have the backbone or the fortitude to, you know, withstand the scrutiny of what's responsive government, of the people, by the people, for the people. I think the last town hall he had, it was mostly senior citizens about 4 years ago, who confronted him about his wanting to cut Medicaid and Medicare, you know, that kind of stuff. Somebody had run a commercial. I'm not sure if you remember or have ever seen of him pushing an image of him pushing an elderly woman off a cliff in a wheelchair. I'm sure you can find it on one of those, you know, social media platforms. But that's the rap he's getting in the community. And again, that disconnected. He wants nothing to do with his constituents. He's amassing a fortune as well from the same group you were talking about, the Wall Street financiers and the bankers and such. And, you know, I just go around asking people who have any inkling of support, ask yourself the primary question. Are you and your family better off, you know, economically, your standard of living than you were 17 years ago when he took office? Do you have more rights as a human being, as a worker, than you did when he took office? And you're going to find the answer is no to both of those questions.
I think it'll be interesting to see certainly how this sort of plays out with President Trump. I mean, they've sort of had sort of an interesting relationship here. I mean, do you expect the president to try to get involved here, try to campaign on behalf of Paul Ryan? And do you think it would make any difference at all, win, lose, or draw?
You know, Trump had come to Janesville during his campaign and held a rally, and he may have been here twice, I believe. And each time he was really putting down Paul Ryan, and he'd get cheers again, from some of those Trump supporters, whatever. So that's been a really peculiar dynamic. You know, the anything that's establishment Trump is, who hasn't he offended or put down at this point? You know, and amongst his supporters, it just doesn't seem to have much effect. You know, and that's true across the board with most issues. So I've looked at the history of this district over time. Little bit. And, you know, this was a seat held by Les Aspin at one point for 20 years from the 70s to the early 90s. And then it was held by another Democrat, Peter Barca, just for one term. And it seems over the lifetime of the district, because of the span of geography, you know, from Janesville, Scotia, it seems like the East End, when it's been held by a Democrat, it's been the turnout, you know, propelled that to the Democratic Party. I don't know if that's true, but that's at least what I gather just by looking at the history of the district, because it's been a real classic swing district in its existence. You know what I mean? It voted for Bush, it's voted for Obama, it's voted for Romney, you know, that kind of
stuff. Yeah, it's not necessarily dyed in the wool. No, it's a good point. I mean, I think in 2012 even, I think Obama won in 08, he lost in 2012, but even then got 47% of the vote. So it wasn't like he was that far off there. And of course, turnout will be the key issue here. And it just seems like that's the other thing. I mean, we saw that certainly in, I think, the Virginia Democratic primary, that, you know, regardless of who people were backing, just a lot of people showed up to vote. I mean, it seems that progressive people are fired up to make a statement here. And in some ways, maybe that could be the biggest death knell to Paul Ryan is not even just the normal voters, but the people who rarely vote or never vote who say, hey, like, there's nothing, you couldn't send a bigger statement than toppling the Speaker of the House. That's for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, when you start talking about, remember, just going back 6 short years ago, Wisconsin citizens signed, I don't know how many, to recall the governor. While it wasn't a successful outcome, the petition circulation and the number of signatures that were gathered in 6 weeks was mind-boggling, like 2 million signatures in 6 weeks.
Mm.
You know, anyway, and a lot of Randy comes out of that, so does Kathy. And thus, their cadre, the activists that are going to be involved in these campaigns, you're going to have a lot of that same energy and activism, I'm certain, and excitement again, much like I was describing my own and my family's, my kids, our children's. Everybody's excited that there's even a contest, you know, a viable candidate that's stepping forward. So I'm seeing that clearly where I'm, you know, just paying attention, you know, listening to what people are thinking and feeling. That's a fantastic thing. You know, it's very optimistic. Bringing about change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly quite interesting to see. I mean, it's one of those districts I certainly never would have predicted there would have been any sort of strong challenger. But, you know, perhaps that's the ultimate lesson of this entire thing here is that, you know, no, we shouldn't be, people who are progressive shouldn't be looking at any district or any state or any area as a, well, we can never win, we can never compete, because it's sort of like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy once you say it.
Yeah, and again, it's a very simple concept. You can't guarantee an outcome, but I can certainly guarantee a better outcome when you show up, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
Simple premise.
You'd think
just
so.
Show up, would you?
Yeah. But I guess the people who are spending the millions and millions of dollars out there, that starts to confuse them about what's simple and what's hard. So one thing I want to get in here before we break, couple minutes, your final thoughts on the Illinois budget deal here, what put place there with Mr. Rauner and the legislature?
Well, again, I'm greatly pleased that the Rauner's held up the budget for one reason and one reason alone, his reform, so-called, eliminating collective bargaining from the rights of workers. That's been the one thing he's been unwilling to compromise on, and he wasn't able to get that. So happy about that as a trade unionist, as a working person. I'm very concerned anytime, again, the pension questions that continue to be unresolved and more tier systems, you know, less pension moving forward, less old age insurance. There's also still a public school funding bill that's sitting on the governor's desk, which he's maintaining he's going to veto, Senate Bill 1. So that's still hanging out there and a great concern. He's still been unwilling to negotiate a successor agreement with 37,000 public employees represented by Council 31 AFSCME. That remains unresolved. So, again, this guy's he's somebody who has just written himself a $50 million check for his campaigns, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what democracy's all about. He's just buying elected office and appointing people to office who share his philosophy. And so there's still a lot at risk. But we're happy that the budget is done. Services will continue. Thanks again to the labor movement, our union particularly, getting court orders to ensure that workers remain paid on the job, you know, that kind of stuff. That's all happened in this process. And you can thank the unions for that.
Along with the weekend there. I think we're going to have to leave it there, Ed, but I appreciate it. Ed Sadlowski from AFSCME District Council 31, also a resident of Janesville, Wisconsin, helping us figure out a little bit what's going on there in Paul Ryan's race. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.